Hello there. It is Thursday, June the 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, intelligence chiefs' testimony on Russia leave lawmakers frustrated.
I'm not prepared to answer your question today.
The former FBI director fired by Donald Trump will testify tomorrow. North Korea is at it again, test firing more missiles. Also ahead, after a break from the music scene, singer Shakira has a new project. It's all on today's International Edition. Top U.S. intelligence and law enforcement chiefs testified on Wednesday about the growing investigation into Russia's alleged meddling in last year's election and President Trump's alleged attempts to rein in the probe of his aides. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, National Security Agency Chief Michael Rogers, Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appeared Wednesday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. All three, including Coates, were reluctant to speak openly.
I don't think this is the appropriate venue to do this in, given that this is an open hearing and a lot of confidential information relative to intelligence or other matters. I just don't feel it's appropriate for me to do that in this situation.
It was the first of 2 days of hearings in Washington focused on the investigation of what Trump says is a witch hunt aimed at undermining his legitimacy of his upset victory in the November election. On Thursday, former FBI Director James Comey, who Trump fired last month, will testify before the panel. Joining me now for more is legal and political analyst James Goodnow. James, thanks so much for being with us. So what was your take on the hearing?
It was painful to watch, and I'm sure it was even more painful in the room. What we saw here was DNI, Dan Coats, NSA Director Mike Rogers, and the Deputy AG and the Acting Director of the FBI essentially refusing to talk about conversations they had with Donald Trump or the White House. And the problem with this was they did not assert any legal basis for this, which was certainly causing Democratic senators great frustration, and frankly, it was causing frustration on the part of GOP senators as well. This really is unprecedented to have a group like this come in and not testify when there's no legal reason for it. Typically, the legal reason would be executive privilege. That was not invoked, so there was no basis for it, which is really getting under the skin of lawmakers right now.
What do you think their reasoning might have been?
It's impossible to know, but if I were to put myself in their position, I would probably be terrified. I know that the stakes are as high as they can be. I know that the entire world is watching this, and I know that if I say the wrong thing, it could have massive political ramifications. Certainly, it would for my job, because I know that one person that's watching would be Donald Trump himself. We know he has his eyes glued to cable news constantly, so I'm worried about that. We know there have been quite a few people who've been fired by Donald Trump. But I'm also concerned because if I say the wrong thing, it may spark a firestorm. So they did what I think a lot of reasonable people would want to do, and that's to keep their mouth shut. If I don't say anything, I can't say anything wrong. And we really did see this group of intelligence leaders come in and be unified in that approach. Now, the question, of course, for Congress and the Senate specifically is, what will they do about that? Donald Trump has the ability to fire these people.
Do you think that they will be more likely to talk when they're in a private hearing or with the special prosecutor?
I do. I think when the cameras are off, I think their blood pressure will drop, and they certainly will reveal more information. And in fact, we know that Director Coates said as much. He said, I'm happy to share information with you, but I'm not going to do it in a public setting. Well, the response from multiple senators is, why not? There's no legal reason for it. He just said, I'm not comfortable with it. I don't think it would be appropriate. You do have these gentlemen here that I think at some level are trying to be guided by what they think is right. But they're trying to keep the debate to a minimum because they know the real firestorm is coming tomorrow when Jim Comey puts up his hand and testifies before the Senate.
He released what he will be using for an opening statement to the press. It seemed like there were some interesting things in there that could cause some problems for the White House. What is your take?
Jim Comey is going to deliver bombshell testimony tomorrow. We've seen that in his prepared remarks. And functionally here, what's happening is Jim Comey is going to confirm everything that we've heard leaked out over the last few weeks, which is very bad for the White House. This entire narrative that, well, we need to see what Jim Comey's going to say now is gone. We know what he's going to say, and it's really bad for the White House, which is going to move them into their default position of, well, do we believe Jim Comey, or do we believe Donald Trump? That's certainly a determination that needs to be made by the members of the Senate or Congress generally, and also by the American people.
Well, one of the things that we did see that that Comey had taken note of was that the president had asked him in a private meeting saying, I need loyalty, I expect loyalty. How big of a problem would a statement like that be for the president of the United States?
The statement on its own is problematic. The statement in conjunction with everything else Jim Comey's going to testify about is far worse. So let's talk about the statement. I expect loyalty. That is something you do not say as president of the United States to the director of the FBI. The FBI is designed to be insulated from political pressures. It's designed to be an independent body. So Donald Trump is undermining that, chipping away at that, eroding that by asking for this loyalty to Donald Trump. This is not a loyalty pledge to anything greater, to the laws, to the United States. It's to a person. It's to the commander-in-chief himself. So that is problematic. But then when you couple that with everything else we saw in terms of Donald Trump on Valentine's Day asking Jim Comey to let this go with respect to Mike Flynn, what's going on with this cloud? We need to lift the cloud in a March 30th phone call. And ultimately, the termination of Jim Comey, you put that together, and that is a very compelling case for obstruction of justice.
All right. Legal and political analyst James Goodnow, thank you so much for your perspective. Now let's get a check in with Andrew Palchewski for what's trending on social media. This is probably going to be too much of a surprise, not what the word on social media is.
Everybody online is talking about this James Comey hearing. Very complicated stuff, but we're already seeing social media talking about Comey's opening statement, which the Senate Intelligence Committee put online. It's quickly spreading across social media, and particular lines of that are getting highlighted. One phrase in particular that's getting a lot of social media attention is when Trump reportedly told Comey during a meeting that he expected loyalty from him. So people judging from this line say that it's going to be a very heated hearing. Comey is going to go after Trump, and it's stoking anticipation for what's going to go down Thursday morning here in the United States.
So, Andrew, it really seems like this thing could on par with the Super Bowl as far as how many people are tuning in to watch it.
One of those people that's going to be watching on social media, President Trump. He's vowed to live tweet the hearing, so it's going to be very interesting what he has to say in real time. Perhaps not surprising that he's choosing to use Twitter. Of course, we know that he uses it very frequently, and White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said earlier this week in a briefing that social media is Trump's most effective way to communicate with the American people. So it's going to be very interesting how many tweets he sends out, what the tenor of those tweets are going to be, if they're going to be very pointed, or if he's going to try to rebut things as they come out, fact by fact, line by line.
And because so many people are planning on watching this and are so, you know, interested in hearing this testimony, it sounds like businesses in D.C., in the nation's capital, are actually trying to cash in on that a little bit.
This is perhaps my favorite nugget of information. Bars and restaurants in Washington, D.C. are going to be opening early to air the hearing. One bar is having an FBI special. You can get either French toast, bacon, and ice cream, or a fried chicken, bacon, and iceberg lettuce sandwich, of course, keeping with that FBI theme. But really, it is one of the most anticipated events in D.C. So you're seeing these bars open up. You're seeing a lot of people talking about this on social media within D.C. and just talking about it around the city. But really, the great thing about social media is that outside of D.C., throughout the country, and really throughout the world, our listeners even around the world can follow along with this when this happens on social media. And that's one of the great things about social media is that you don't have to sit there and watch this hearing for 8, 9, 10 hours, however long it's going to go on. You can follow social media. You can get the key lines, the key moments, and the key snippets. So I expect a lot of people will be doing that tomorrow. I expect a lot of trending hashtags, trending names, as we saw during the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Wednesday, as different people were testifying, their names began trending. So I think we're going to see probably some viral moments come out of this.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. We will keep an eye on it. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. On Election Day in Britain, uncertainty about conservatives' lead. Trump offers to mediate Qatar's diplomatic crisis. Canada will increase its military spending 70% in 10 years. And NASA selects 12 new astronauts from a crush of applicants. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. South Korea said today that North Korea test-launched several land-to-ship missiles. Seoul's Joint Chiefs of Staff said several projectiles were fired early Thursday from the North's eastern coast town of Wonsan. This would be the fourth North Korean missile test in a month, coming after the UN Security Council imposed more sanctions on Pyongyang last week. Bruce Bennett, senior international defense researcher with RAND Corporation, talks about it with VOA's Victor Beatty.
North Korea has been doing a series of tests of different missiles. Back in late March and early and throughout April, the missiles all failed. They didn't even fly very far. They exploded. Since the beginning of May, they've been more successful. They've had now three ballistic missile tests, and now these tests today. These are to demonstrate new capabilities, to suggest that they're advancing and covering new areas, but also to give Kim Jong-un some internal cover from the hits he's taking from the Security Council and elsewhere, from China in particular, on their coal import cutoff, trying to demonstrate that Kim Jong-un is still a god. He's still very powerful and capable of doing important things.
Are these land-to-ship missiles carrying not just conventional but nuclear weapons?
Probably not nuclear. They're probably too small for that. But we really don't know at this stage. This could be something new, or it could be something in the category of missiles that they've fired before against shipping. But these are longer range than anything I'm familiar with.
One analyst suggests that these are in response to the U.S. nuclear submarine USS Cheyenne arriving, whose home port is Pearl Harbor, arrived in the South Korean port of Busan on Tuesday. And of course, the U.S. has two aircraft carriers and their support vessels in the Sea of Japan. The U.S. is showing quite a bit of naval muscle in the region.
The U.S. has been showing a lot of naval capability in the region, trying to demonstrate that we're prepared to try to deal with North Korea. But, you know, the missiles they launched probably don't have to do much with the submarine, because as long as it's submerged, the surface-to-ship missile isn't going to work. So it's probably more just a demonstration by North Korea than much of anything else.
This is their fourth missile test since Moon Jae-in took office in South Korea May 10, pledging to engage in dialogue with North Korea. Is that hope dead now?
Well, I don't know that it's dead. President Moon and his advisors are really intent on trying to work with North Korea. But besides these missile launches, the North Koreans rejected South Korean humanitarian organizations authorized by the Moon administration, rejected them coming into North Korea. So North Korea doesn't seem like it's anxious to be interacting with South Korea right now, and that will set President Moon back.
Bruce, will these new UN sanctions bite into North Korea?
Yeah, it's not that they're going to force North Korea into giving up its nuclear weapons, but there will be people who are specifically hurt and organizations which are specifically hurt. And they demonstrate that anybody who is prepared to do business with North Korea The U.S. and even China and other countries in the world are prepared to act against them.
As the Trump administration suggests, is China stepping up at this point?
Certainly stepping up in the sense that it agreed to the new Security Council resolution. Also stepping up that they've been pretty upset with North Korea this year. A whole sequence of actions where there's been back and forth between China and North Korea, but not upset to the point where China is willing to give up on North Korea. They still don't want American troops up on the Chinese border. So China's more prepared to do things, but not to go too far.
All right, that's Bruce Bennett, senior international defense researcher with RAND Corporation. Iran's Revolutionary Guards are blaming Saudi Arabia for terror attacks Wednesday at two locations in Tehran. Tehran's police chief was quoted in Iranian media as saying five suspects had been arrested in connection with the attacks that left at least 13 people dead and dozens of others wounded. IS militants immediately claimed responsibility. Ali Vaez, senior Iran analyst with the International Crisis Group, tells International Edition's Sarah Williams his reaction to the Revolutionary Guard statement.
Look, there are different voices coming out of Iran. The Supreme Leader called the attacks firecrackers that won't affect Iran. The Speaker of Parliament, where 12 people died today, said that this was just a trivial attack. And the Revolutionary Guard has vowed to revenge these attacks and said It drew a direct line between the attacks and the joint Saudi-U.S. effort to push back against Iran's regional policies. I think one has to understand this in the context of the deepening war of words between Iran and its Sunni neighbors, especially Saudi Arabia. And this is likely to diminish the odds of any kind of reconciliation anytime soon. But, you know, this also diminishes the odds of any kind of de-escalation and sectarian tensions that the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is fueling across the region from Yemen to Iraq and Syria.
The fact that Islamic State, I think, pretty quickly took responsibility for this. I know in the past, IS has attacked Iran. I mean, is this an escalation in sort of the conflict, I guess, between Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims?
Look, this is the first time that ISIS has been able to strike Iran inside its borders. But, you know, the fact that in the past few years it had failed to do so wasn't because of lack of trying. You know, in 2016, the Iranians reported the arrest of people who were trying to conduct similar attacks in Iran, and they reported arrest of 18 people who were trying to recruit new members for ISIS through social media. But the reality is, I think Iran has been quite lucky to have remained an island of stability in a sea of chaos for such a long period of time. And at the end of the day, insecurity has spilled over from across its borders. Remember that Iran has long borders with Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have presence of ISIS and a lot of disorder that is often exploited by ISIS. It seems to me that the targets in Tehran were chosen not for maximizing fatalities, but for maximizing the political impact. You know, the perpetrators targeted two key symbolic pillars of the Islamic Republic, the shrine of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the theocratic system in Iran, and the parliament, which is the center of its republican institution. And this was, you know, a strike at the heart of the capital of a country that, in the eyes of Salafi jihadists, is responsible for propping up the Assad regime and is after dominating the region. ISIS, I think, probably hopes that this could turn into a powerful recruitment tool at a time that ISIS is losing a lot of ground in Iraq and Syria and is about to lose control over its key capitals in Mosul and Raqqa.
Some observers say Islamic State is increasingly really, I guess, desperate, you know, to sort of score a significant hit in another area.
Yeah, and this explains why it took credit for attacks in Iran while they were still ongoing, because in most cases it takes about 12 to 24 hours before ISIS claims responsibility. The recent attack in London, it took them about 24 hours to claim it. But this time it was even before the guns had fallen silent in Tehran. And it's because, you know, this is the first time that they have been able to attack Iran on its soil, and it has great symbolic value for them. And it shows to their supporters that they're still relevant.
That's Ali Vaez, senior Iran analyst with the International Crisis Group. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now with entertainment news. For that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. So, Nicole, a lot of people in the celebrity world were betting that George Clooney would stay a bachelor forever, but now we know he's not only happily married, but he has a bigger family.
George and Amal Clooney are now going to be known as mom and dad. Amal gave birth on Tuesday, June 6th, to two beautiful, probably beautiful twins, and they went with the names Ella and Alexander Clooney. It's very exciting because a lot of George's fans know that he was a bachelor for many, many years. And then finally, this beautiful Amal came into his life, and now he has a complete package with the two twins. And actually, his rep released the statement confirming the twins' birth and said that mom and both babies are doing well, and that it made a little joke and said that George was heavily sedated, but he should recover in a few days. So obviously that's a joke. I'm sure that he was present for the whole thing. The family plans to have somewhat of a quiet life now that they have welcomed the twins. They will be living in England, but I hope that they're not going to be too quiet and we can see the baby soon, because I'm sure they're both beautiful, with George and Amal being as good looking as they both are. So congratulations to them.
Absolutely. Hope we get to see a photo for sure very soon. And there are some rumors that another big celebrity could potentially be having a baby soon.
Yes, Halle Berry made headlines this week because at 50 years old, she posed on the red carpet holding her belly. And so a lot of people were saying, oh, is Halle pregnant at 50? You know, Janet Jackson just had her baby at 50. So a lot of people were speculating on this week. And her rep came out right away and said that she is not pregnant, but also said, and actually Halle in the past has said that it was very hard for her to conceive her second child, Maceo. He's 3 years old now, so she was at 47 when she welcomed him. So she said because of all of that, she is not pregnant, and she even joked about it on Instagram, sharing a beautiful photo of herself with the caption that said, "Can a girl just eat some steak and fries?" So no baby for Halle Berry, but still kind of funny news.
All right, thanks so much. That's Nicole Moschella, Rare.us content editor. Latin music star Shakira has a new album out, El Dorado. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the Colombian native used her own relationship with Spanish football star Gerard Piqué as her inspiration.
Shakira is probably best known in the English-speaking world for her smash breakout hit Hips Don't Lie from her seventh studio album Oral Fixation. The 40-year-old Colombian song for the 2010 World Cup football tournament, Waka Waka, became the most popular song ever to be associated with that event. The 2010 World Cup is also where she met her partner, Barcelona football star Gerard Piqué. On her new album, El Dorado, Shakira says she drew inspiration from her relationship with Piqué.
He looks at me with those eyes like, oh, you know, like really appreciating the fact that I almost paid an homage to that moment in our lives when we met each other, and that the turning point in our lives when everything changed for both of us.
Shakira says she felt it was time to return to work, after spending the past few years concentrating on her family and raising the couple's children.
I pressed pause on that, and now I hit play. I formed a family, and it's the most wonderful thing, the most important thing to me. And before, I used to be the center of my whole world, and the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega of my whole world, and now my kids and my family are that one priority and the most important thing for me.
Oye, me cago, llévame en tu bicicleta. Que si hacen que algún día demuestras en Tayrona, después no querrás ir pa' Barcelona.
Getting back into the studio to record El Dorado proved more difficult than Shakira expected. But when she heard the song La Bicicleta, or The Bicycle, and learned that she could sing it with fellow Colombian musician Carlos Vives, Shakira says her creativity blossomed.
It opened up a whole world of possibilities, especially knowing that I could release my music on a song-by-song basis. It completely changed my game, and it incentivized me to make more music and not take this whole project as a whole body of work.
Shakira also shares the mic with another Colombian singer, Maluma, on the song Chantaje. Since its release last year, Chantaje has tallied more than 1.2 billion views on YouTube and 326 million plays on Spotify. Shakira also shares tracks with Prince Royce on Deja Vu, reggaeton singer Nicky Jam on Perro Fiel, and an English song with Nasri Atwe of Magic, What We Said. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There has been a spike in violence in one of Africa's poorest and most war-torn countries, the Central African Republic, known as CAR. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs released a report this month saying that the frequency and brutality of attacks against communities have surged to levels last seen in 2014. Entire towns have been emptied, houses burnt down, and women and children brutally killed. The terrifying violence by armed militias in the CAR started in 2012 and intensified when a mostly Muslim rebel group, the Selaka, overthrew President François Bozizé in 2013. Atrocities committed by the Selaka gave rise to a predominantly Christian group to counter it, the Anti-Balaka, which similarly committed untold human rights abuses. Sectarian attacks by each group against each other and against innocent civilians devastated the country. An accord agreed to in 2015 by the rival militias requiring them to disarm, as well as a presidential election in 2016, raised hope for a new and more peaceful future for the country. But many armed rebels did not disarm, and violence has continued and, as the UN has documented, recently escalated. The security situation in CAR deteriorated last month, leading to more than 300 people killed and over 100,000 displaced. In southeastern CAR, six peacekeepers from MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping mission in CAR, were killed near the town of Bangassou. In the central town of Bria, violence between rebel groups resulted in thousands of civilians pouring into makeshift camps. The United States is deeply concerned by the recent violence. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We strongly condemn these acts of violence and the targeted attacks against humanitarian actors, whose sole purpose in the CAR is to provide life-saving support to the population." Spokesperson Nauert wrote that the United States mourns the deaths of the UN peacekeepers as well. The security and support provided by MINUSCA are essential for the CAR to move beyond crisis, she noted. "We commend President Faustin Archange Touadéra and his government for their commitment to justice, the rule of law, and accountability for perpetrators of mass atrocities, including through the creation of the Special Criminal Court," said Ms. Nauert. "The United States fully supports justice and reconciliation, not only as measures for individuals who have suffered, but as essential steps towards building a peaceful and inclusive CAR."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.